You're watching Straight Talk Africa. I'm Hady Adams. Hello and a warm welcome to you. What does a free and fair election really look like? What shapes and what shakes people's faith in the ballot box? A new study shows support for elections has dropped among Africans. This week, we put election integrity and voting rights under the microscope. We'll ask African voters if they believe in the ballot and if they'll keep lining up at the polls. We'll also examine what and who is behind claims of rigged elections in African countries and other parts of the world. We'll have expert analysis and your opinion. Straight Talk Africa starts now. American elections have long been promoted across Africa and around the world as a gold standard to learn from and follow. But the most recent US presidential poll brought conflict, confusion, and crisis. Many supporters of former Republican US President Donald Trump did not believe he had lost to his Democratic rival, Joe Biden. On January 6th, some of those Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol building and tried to prevent Biden from taking office. Now there is also growing controversy in the U.S. about efforts to restrict Americans' ability to vote. Thousands of demonstrators recently marched on Washington demanding that the federal government take action to protect voting rights nationwide. VOA Saqib al-Islam was there and filed this report.
The movement is the same as it was 58 years ago with the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., and so is the message.
It's important because Dr. King was here, and Dr. King secured the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This is a continuation of that effort. We are here to protect what Dr. King secured.
This year's march on Washington is aimed at reversing changes to the Voting Rights Act of 1965, made by the U.S. Supreme Court in a 2013 decision.
It's a racist system. It's the system that wasn't built for fairness or equality. So our votes matter.
With gerrymandering and voter suppression and the different things that a certain party is doing to keep people from being able to vote easily, They're stripping American citizens from a basic right.
This year, several Republican-controlled state legislators have passed bills that tighten the rules around casting ballots and running elections. Supporters of the new laws say they are necessary to prevent election fraud, and that the John R. Lewis Advancement Act of 2021, which would restore elements of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and recently passed the U.S. House, is unnecessary.
So there's no threat to the voting rights law. It's against the law to discriminate in voting on the basis of race already. And so I think it's unnecessary.
We haven't had fraud in this country in elections since probably the turn of the previous century. The last election, there was almost zero voter fraud. This is just an excuse to take away our right to vote.
Protesters here were pushing for several new laws that they say will help protect voters' access to ballots.
If it were possible to eliminate gerrymandering, to make it easier for people to register to vote, to make it easier for people who don't have identification to get an ID card.
Along with voting rights, many here were demanding that the elected officials push to make Washington, D.C., now a federal enclave, the 51st state. 140 organizations organized this march, during which member of Congress, along with Martin Luther King III, vowed to protect democracy, make D.C. a state, and ensure fair and easy access to the ballot box.
So Saqib al-Islam, VOA News, Washington.
Well, voting rights and the January riot at the U.S. Capitol to overturn the 2020 election results are high on the agenda for lawmakers right now. For perspective on what's ahead and what's at stake, I spoke to VOA's White House Bureau Chief, Patsy Wirakuswara. Patsy, thank you so much for joining me. Please give us the latest on these hearings into the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. We've seen a U.S. House Select Committee now subpoena advisors and associates to former President Donald Trump and, of course, some of the actual Capitol rioters. What is this committee trying to learn? What is it trying to understand? And how will having these hearings actually help ensure that we don't see a repeat of what happened on January 6th?
And one way to think about this, and this is maybe something that your viewers are familiar with, is this is some sort of a truth and reconciliation commission. So once a country has gone through trauma, the same way the U.S. has gone through with January 6th insurrection attempt, what happens is usually people come together to look at what happened, to have a narrative about what happened, and then to learn about how to avoid this in the future. Now, when this process started, it was supposed to be bipartisan. As you know, that did not go well. It quickly devolved. And essentially what the Democrats are saying now is that Republicans are blocking the investigations. Meanwhile, Republicans who support President Trump say that this is just another continuation of the witch hunt, and they continue to further promote the theory, what the Democrats and critics of President Trump call the big lie, which is the claim that President Trump won the election, even though it was President Biden who did it. Now, as you said, that's correct. Right now, the commission is trying to subpoena the close circles of President Trump, four of them, including his former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, as well as strategist Steve Bannon.
Now, of course, Patsy, one of the most contentious and polarizing debates in Washington right now is that of voting rights. Several U.S. states, as we've seen, are passing legislation that could make it harder for some Americans to vote. And U.S. President Joe Biden is now under pressure to do something at the federal, sort of the national level. Why is this such a polarizing issue in Washington? And why is President Biden being criticized for not, you know, getting the job done on this?
Well, voting rights has always been a polarizing issue in the U.S., and it has become increasingly so. And it is important for President Biden to take care of this issue because it is certainly a Democratic priority. So if you think about it, elections in the U.S. is not like one national elections, right? It's like 50 different elections happening in 50 states, and they all have different regulations and different rules depending on whether it's a Republican run or a Democratic run state. Now, in general, Democrats want to expand voting rights. They want as many people as possible to have access to the ballot. Meanwhile, Republicans want to limit that access because they feel that that's the necessary thing to protect the integrity of the ballot, to avoid voter fraud, and so on. Now, of course, this comes down to whatever is their political interest. Democratic base tends to be more brown and black, more people of color, and so they want expanded access to everybody so that everyone can vote and therefore will have a bigger say in the election process. And the Republicans want the opposite. So that's why this is a contentious issue. This is something that the White House is clearly fighting for. President Biden has assigned his vice president, Kamala Harris, to take care of this. And we'll see how far they can go with the legislation.
Patsy, what are the potential consequences for future U.S. elections if we do see the John Lewis Voting Rights Act signed into law by the U.S. president? And what are the potential consequences for the country if we don't?
So the John Lewis Voting Rights Act is designed to restore the provisions of the original Voting Rights Act of 1965, which has been gutted by several Supreme Court decisions in recent years. And so the Democrats and the supporters of this bill say that if it passes, it will stop states, particularly Republican states, from creating laws that limit access to the ballot. Meanwhile, Republicans say that this is federal overreach, and it's up to state to determine how and when and, you know, in what manner their citizens of each state can vote. Because as we said before, it's not like one election in this U.S., but it's 50 different elections. So it can vary differently from state to state, who can vote, what, you know, ID you need to vote, when the ballot boxes are open, whether or not you can do early voting, absentee voting, and so forth.
And that was VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wirakuswara speaking to me here in Washington. Most Africans want elections, and generally people still believe in the ballot box. But that support is not as strong as it was 10 years ago. Many voters on the continent simply don't think elections are effective in holding their country's leaders accountable. That's what we're learning from a new study done by the research institution Afrobarometer. They conducted a survey among voters in 18 African countries about confidence in elections. Now, here's a brief overview of some of the findings we thought you might find interesting. 4 in 10, that's 42% of Africans surveyed, believe elections are effective in ensuring that representatives to parliament reflect voters' views. And the same number of people believe elections ensure voters can remove non-performing leaders. The Afrobarometer survey also asked voters if they think their country's most recent election was free and fair. Many voters, as you can see, in Burkina Faso and Ghana believed their elections were free and fair. Just over a half of voters surveyed in Uganda and Nigeria agreed. You can also see those percentages drop in Angola, with the lowest percentage in Gabon. And overall, the survey found nearly three quarters of Africans want regular, open and honest elections. So we wanted to hear how voters felt in their own words. We hit the streets in three African countries and asked people there if they have trust in the ballot box and if they would vote in the next election. Here's what voters in Kenya said.
I don't trust at all, because these guys, if you are given both, they are just corrupt all over. So I don't trust election in Kenya anymore. I will vote. I'm going to check if I can vote for someone or not. But I'm going to vote. What I know, I'm going to vote, but with circumstances.
When elections in our country is fair, then I think we might not have so many violence cases like murder. People will be united. Yes, I will vote, because it is my freedom to vote and choose the person I need who can bring changes on our country.
Kenyans, we don't trust elections in Kenya, because the election has been rigged several times. So so many Kenyans are disappointed. So when you meet some, they'll tell you, sio lazima wapige kura. There's no need of voting, because the system will elect the leaders. Yes, I personally I'll vote, because when I vote is when I'll remove the leader that I don't want to lead. If you don't vote, then the one that you don't want to lead will still go ahead. So your vote is your weapon. But so many Kenyans will tell you that they don't need to vote, because they don't trust the elections right now.
So some voters don't trust elections, but will vote anyway. What does this mean for voter confidence? That's the focus of this week's Straight Talk Africa discussion. Let's quickly go around our group here and do some proper introductions. We, of course, have three South Africans on this panel and one Kenyan, but Vincent Makori says this doesn't bother him at all. He's not worried about being outnumbered. He says he will survive. Hrushti Nakadin is the Senior Global Advisor for Training and Capacity Building with the International Foundation for Electoral Systems. He's worked on elections throughout the African continent and other parts of the world. Pibokushle Mnyandu is a very familiar face with us. He is a lecturer of African Studies and Culture at Howard University. And of course, my colleague, Vincent Makori. He is the managing editor for TV in VOA's English to Africa news service. Gentlemen, a warm welcome to you. And I want to use the Afrobarometer survey as a sort of jumping off point for our discussion. Hrushti, I'm going to start with you. Is what we're seeing more about a decline in people's faith in elections, or are we really just seeing particular trends around politicians and other actors working very hard to shake people's confidence in election systems?
Thanks, Heidi. I think it's a bit of both. What we are seeing very clearly through surveys like Afrobarometer, and even if you just speak with ordinary folks from the continent, you'll find that there's a growing frustration when it comes to issues of democracy and governance. But by the same token, I mean, that frustration which is there that you mentioned, you're also seeing more and more that elections themselves are under pressure from politicians. It used to be that it was the opposition that used to argue that elections potentially are going to be fraudulent and so forth. Nowadays, if one looks across the globe, it's actually ruling party leaders or the incumbents sometimes arguing also about that. So you're seeing this interplay between, on the one hand, growing frustrations. While people believe in elections, they don't necessarily believe in the fruits of those elections, which is a very fine point. But by the same token, you're also seeing elections almost under pressure or under attack. So that creates a very complex sort of interplay between these two things. I mean, you see the level of frustration, and then you see massive numbers of voters pitch up in Zambia. And you see high voter turnout. And even during COVID, you've seen countries like Togo, Central African Republic, and Niger all have really high voter turnouts during a time period when the World Bank says globally voter turnout is on the decline by at least 10%. We are seeing these instances on the African continent where people are kind of breaking that myth that there's a huge problem with elections. People still go to the polls, they stand in long queues, they cast their votes. And as we're seeing in some instances, Zambia, case in point, more and more people actually going to the polls. And in the case like Zambia, you're seeing change coming from that. So it's a very complex interplay between a variety of different factors.
Look, one can't help but be taken aback by what we're seeing here in the United States, with election results now being disputed. There were calls for the election to be overturned. Now, you know, this phenomenon might be somewhat new here in the US, but it has been happening in some African countries for a long, long time, as we all know. But generally speaking, Pio Kushle, what is more important here? That people feel free to vote for the candidate of their choice, or that the act of voting actually leads to change of leadership?
I'd say both, because I think if let's define elections perhaps around the idea of democracy. So if elections are part and parcel of multi-party democracy, and the quality of multi-party democracy then in any given country can be judged by the quality of its elections. So the extent to which people participate, the extent to which participation, there are no punitive economic factors that may perhaps lead people or discourage people to participate. In the United States, I can think of one, for example, that election day is not a holiday, a public holiday. So there's been a movement then in the United States and in the world around this general malaise around certain things that we've taken for granted about democracy. Like, should it be a universal holiday in every country when there's an election? In other words, people are trying from grassroots level to improve the quality of the elections, and by so doing, improve the quality of that democracy. And I would agree with my colleague that they were seeing a spike in this movement, and as a result, optimism.
Vincent, tell us about your experience covering elections, both here in the United States and on the continent, especially Kenya's elections, which are almost always very widely watched elections. And as we saw, we spoke to Kenyans themselves earlier on in the show, I found it very interesting that people say, look, I had a problem with the last election. I don't trust the system, but I will vote again.
What I can say from my coverage of elections is that people across the continent of Africa believe in something. They have a hope that something somewhere along the way is going to change. They get repeatedly frustrated by the election process, by the election results, but they still believe that somewhere along the way, their participation in elections will help to change society. And they keep that hope. You could say that is where I would use the expression, they keep that hope alive, that they will somewhere along the way get it right. They never want to give up on participating in an election, in as much as sometimes actually, even as they're doing it, they are a little uncomfortable about what their vote will mean and what the results will be. In fact, some of them cast their ballots and they immediately start doubting whether their vote is going to make any difference, whether it's going to count, whether it will be counted, in fact, to begin with. And so I think it symbolizes their hope for a better tomorrow, and they keep trying.
Rushdie, you've worked many elections in countries across the African continent and, of course, the rest of the world. Please tell us, what does a free and fair election really look like? I mean, versus a rigged election. How can an ordinary citizen know, look, these are the signs of a free and fair election, and these are the signs that will tell me that my election was not free and fair in my country, rigged, essentially?
I mean, the definitions of free and fair have been around for a little while. I mean, when we talk about a free election, we talk about one where all the citizens in a country are able to vote for the candidate of their choice. And when one talks about a free election, it's where all of those votes have equal power and are counted accurately. And when one starts drilling down in what that actually translates to, I mean, we talk about the right to register to vote, access to reliable information about the elections, equitable access to actually run for public office, access to the polls or some other method of actually casting your vote, an election which is free of intimidation, an election which is free from fraud, and that you've got faith in the accuracy of the count and the election results, and that there is a high level of tolerance around the acceptance of the election results. Now, when one starts talking about flawed elections or these elections that are considered to be rigged, you start seeing a whole different picture. And people are able to pick that up, ordinary citizens. It's not necessarily for experts to kind of just say. People have a sense that while they might not believe in all of the detail and so forth, they can see when the rules of the game, which is all of these things which I will be describing, talk about the manipulation of elections well before election day, because elections are no longer manipulated on election day. In fact, some say that's for amateurs. The folks who are really intent on doing this, they look to reconstruct the rules of the game, setting in place laws around identification, all kinds of restrictions way before election day. They look at things like voting boundaries, those constituencies that people voting in, how those could be set up in a way which favors their political party. They look at making things difficult to register as a voter, setting high bars. There's folks try and hide the amount of money which is spent on campaign financing. That kind of lack of transparency of how public funding is being spent or private funding in terms of campaigning. They look at control of the media, looking at and to manipulate the media in some form or way so you control the message. And then also during the electoral campaign, and that's often when you start seeing issues of elections-related violence emerging. Those are all critical elements. And, I mean, for us, we kind of, as election professionals, so to speak, we kind of look at things and say, what are the elements which relate to what we refer to as systemic manipulation, where the law is sort of very subtly changed in order to favor a particular political party? We obviously look at issues of fraud, which is purposeful. But then there's another element where we kind of look at malpractice, which might be accidental or incompetent. So all of those things kind of combine to create a picture where one could really unpack whether an election has been rigged or not by looking back over a period of time. But I must say, I mean, ordinary citizens, I find ordinary voters are well capable of being able to identify where things weren't completely right. And that creates that feeling of discontent often. And maybe it might be through people acting in a little social media bubble where they feed each other stories and so forth. But that's also where the critical role of the media comes in terms of being able to convey factual reporting and all of those kinds of things. But those are just some of the processes that we can look at when looking at free and fair elections and what one doesn't look like.
Vincent, I'm going to come to you in a moment to talk about fake news, but Peter Kushley, I want to ask you first, who'll be taking a page from whose book? I mean, just the optics of people disputing a US presidential election. And then you think, we've seen this movie before. What are countries in Africa to make of what they're seeing here in the United States right now? And does that embolden those who are in the business of manipulating elections at any point?
At any point. I like your question when you say manipulation of elections at any point, because we've already heard mentioned this misinformation is a big problem that the Americans have actually, rightly so, have started to tackle. But things like misinformation, they manifest differently on the continent. Because in South Africa, for example, the Twitter space, it has different languages. So what might be misinformation in English may not necessarily be misinformation if it's not available in isiZulu, isiXhosa, or Afrikaans. So you have these sub-communities that we must reckon with when we are discussing how to stem misinformation, because I think they hold solutions. If we kind of, where we find instances of misinformation, we could actually work to counter it using people's languages, because this also gets to the point you were mentioning earlier of barriers to elections, barriers of entry for political parties, barriers of entry for in local elections, for example. Can an illiterate person run for a local election? Well, maybe illiterate in the kind of lingua franca, so to speak. Maybe they can, and they can stem misinformation if things are put more in African languages. But we haven't seen much enthusiasm for this, though, unfortunately, on the African continent.
And Vincent, I wonder what you make of sort of this deterioration in the quality of the information that we're seeing that's out there for voters about elections, especially in the digital era. Can you evaluate for us the role that the traditional media plays and has been playing in bringing information to voters, and also the power and effects of social media, especially when it comes around election time?
The role of the media has never been more critical, as it should, it is at this time. And this is because in this age of social media, information travels really fast on social media. Everybody has access to a cell phone, and even to the remotest part of the continent, someone has a cell phone and they can get information instantaneously. And the challenge is that the messages that are disseminated through social media get to so many people at the same time and can be replicated over and over on different platforms. Now, the challenge that the mainstream media has is to catch up, catching up with the information by providing accurate information, correcting the misinformation that is outside. But at times we have had situations where, because the media is also in a rush to try and get the coverage or pass, report on a particular issue as fast as possible, they have actually fed off social media misinformation. And some of this information is information that is coming from what looks like legitimate sources. Sometimes it's attributed to certain politicians, certain people of influence in society. So the media, to do a good job, needs to go a little deeper than that, go get into the background of what information that is out there and get verify the information so that when you come to whatever platform you're using, you can disseminate the accurate information. Now, the challenge of that is that you may not be so fast. You have to be willing to be a little slower in getting your information out, because to get all the facts right, you can't be too fast to publish or to broadcast. But then to retain the credibility, I think the persistency in only having accurate and verifiable information will be the savior of the media.
And we'll bring you more from my discussion with Piwakhu Shlemnyandu, Rushdie Nakadeen and Vincent Makori after the break. But first, Angolans go to the polls next year, so we hit the streets there to ask if citizens trust their country's elections and if they plan to vote.
I'm not certain about anything because within the political parties there are already conflicts, and that makes us uncertain about what's going to happen in 2022.
In 2022, I will not vote. I will not go to the ballot boxes because the process is never fair. It is never transparent. And also, no matter how much the opposition party gets in the elections, a percentage of 89 or 99%, it will not win, because we know how here in Angola these election processes take place.
I will not give this primary a null vote, so it goes to the ruling party. But I will vote. I will vote for the opposition. I took a look at the party's election platform, and they have a lot of good ideas about the way they want to govern.
If our rulers are fair, I believe the elections will be fair too. I believe we should all vote. Only by voting we will be able to be part of the political process, because it's useless for us to be critical of the government and then not to vote. Only by voting we will choose who will govern us better.
If we want a better Angola, we have to go to the ballot boxes. Staying at home and not voting is the same thing as doing nothing, and then you wouldn't be claiming your rights.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Today we're talking about election integrity. We asked Nigerian voters if they trust elections in their country and if they plan to cast a ballot in the future.
I'm not even sure say election go fit dey proper, because when you go to vote, when you see say this is the person where is supposed to win the election, when they go there on that table, they turn outside down. I'm not sure say I can vote if you vote, it is something resort. I don't see the resort. I don't see increased resort. Huh? What can I go online for sun inside the rain? We queue for them. At the end of the day, they don't even know what they go on again.
Like, there's no country that does not face difficulties. Every country faces their own difficulty. There's no smooth country anywhere. We just have to work together to make a better Nigeria.
What I'm seeing in this country now, I don't think that election will even hold. Because people have already made up their mind not to go out and vote. Because even vote for them, what they promise us is not what we are seeing. You understand? We have encountered a lot of disappointments. It has resulted to the extent that nobody is supposed to be voting again. Because the people who are voting, who we are voting for, when they go in there, they do their own things. And we don't see what they promise us. So I don't think we can vote this season. This next election, I don't think we can make the voting.
It's necessary that we should elect so that we know somebody that we take care of Nigeria than what we are seeing now. So we should vote to know our right, to know who we need.
No, everybody know that the election in Nigeria is not working. I didn't trust the election in Nigeria. Even though my vote will not count, I will vote.
You don't even need to be asking me that, because after this regime, I don't think I have faith for anything about election here. I don't belong to APC, I don't belong to PDP. I belong to Buhari. As long as Buhari will not be contesting next, I'm done with the election.
And now we've heard from some Nigerians about how they feel about elections in their country. Let's continue now with our discussion about what shapes and what shakes people's faith in elections. My guests are Rushdie Nakadeen, Piwakhu Shlemnyandu, and VOA's own Vincent Makori. You know, I always worry about the quality of the information that people have access to. Misinformation, disinformation, fake news is everywhere, and it's free. I mean, accurate, balanced news, well-researched reporting often sits behind a paywall. So if the truth costs money, how can we ensure that people have access to good, accurate information, especially around election time?
I would say there are two ways to think about this. We could think about it as a democratization of the information space. And this cannot be a bad thing. That what people now call content can actually, unfortunately, also make it to being news. And content is not something that, someone verifies before they put it out there. So there's been a blurring of the line between content and news. And one necessarily does not mean the other. So there's a good part of this aspect that many people who, with the cell phone, as we've heard Vincent say, can actually counter government misinformation. One big one in South Africa is when citizens make viral civil servants' inefficiency, right? A policeman or woman sleeping on the job, perhaps an inebriated police. So accountability has come about from this democratization of the information space. However, then, I would agree with my colleague, it has poses a challenge to the mainstream media to kind of rise up to this this proliferation of content makers and match them. So I'm optimistic, though, about this aspect of it being a democratization of space.
You know, one of the other challenges is that those who create content on social media, most of them don't have to have any background in journalism. Now, those of us who've gone through journalism training, we've learned certain things, for example, on, you know, how to verify the accuracy of information, how to ensure that the source can be reliable, and even how to protect our sources. Those who are working on social media and creating content, not all of them, but there's a great number of people who do not have this kind of training in journalism and the ethics of journalism, but they get the clicks, they get the numbers, they get the excitement. And, you know, fake news is fake because it looks like real, but it's not really accurate. But it's usually more exciting and more it's more damaging in some cases. Not to deny the fact that social media has actually, as Pua has just said, helped in some cases to highlight you know, certain bad actors in society, including politicians or government officials. But it's a challenge. I'll maintain this. As this space gets more democratized, we don't have control over the consumers, and the consumers choose what they want to take. And sometimes what is on social media is more appealing, more immediate, and easier to share also, because they also become actually, they become part of it. They actually help to spread this information. And it's exciting when they feel like they've shared it. And they have helped to spread the same information far and wide. So it's quite a challenge. It is a big challenge.
To echo what my colleagues are saying, is that what we're seeing today in kind of this modern era is that election campaigning has become far more sophisticated. You suddenly see the Bell Pottingers, the Cambridge Analyticas, big PR companies getting involved and getting paid big money to do this and tapping into the ordinary fears, the anger, the mistrust, which is already in society, and using social media to kind of amplify and replicate that. The onus is then not just on journalists to actually be doing this, but it becomes a whole of society. People was talking about kind of raising the bar. I think that's such an important thing, because it used to be that election authorities themselves running elections, they would only worry about putting the polls together and making sure everybody gets to vote and so on. Nowadays, they themselves need to be participating in this whole myth-busting kind of exercise, fact-checking and so forth. I looked yesterday at the South African IEC, the Independent Election Commission's website, and they've got a tool there which allows people to report misinformation or instances like that, which I think is great. But the challenge is also that we need to kind of, you mentioned, Heidi, this information divide which exists between what's commonly available and what's accessible only through certain media consumers. We do need to find ways to kind of break down those barriers so that the level of media literacy in society is improved, on that people kind of become more discerning about or questioning what it is that they're receiving and whether they believe it or not. The challenge is and has been exacerbated by the COVID crisis, where everybody's kind of spreading all kinds of weird stories about the vaccine doing this or that, so forth. So we need to recognize that when it's election time, the elections do provide a bit of a magnifying glass as to what's happening in society at that moment in time. And if you've got massive levels of distrust generally, the election's just going to increase that, and most likely you're going to see greater misinformation fueled by campaign money that's being spent on professionals whose job it is to manipulate people in a particular direction. So it's a complicated environment, and I think it's more than just journalists who need to pay attention to this, and more people need to kind of step up, and that includes election authorities as well.
Pipo Kushle, I also wonder sometimes if this is also just about a lack of focus or a lack of investment in voter education. I mean, how much does the average voter really know and understand about how elections work, what goes into vote tabulation? I mean, the entire process. This was a question we always discussed and asked in South Africa as well. I mean, how much do people know beyond the fact that they have the right to vote? Is enough money being spent on voter education, ensuring that the electorate is well informed about elections? When I see what's happening here in the United States, look, the election system is already very complex, but then I can't help but wonder to what extent the average voter really understands the mechanics of the election system.
Education is very important. Education is in understanding the election, the electoral process, and in understanding democracy itself. What's the meaning of democracy? Where, since a typical South African in Enkandla, KwaZulu-Natal, a rural area of KwaZulu-Natal, would like to know, how does this connect to my grandmother getting her pension on time, myself getting my ID when I turn 16 to do matric without bribing anyone? The extent to which the democratic process answers these practical, daily, existential questions of people is the extent to which we can judge democracy or a people as having been educated enough to make the right decisions, democratic decisions for themselves. But unfortunately, in South Africa, you mentioned South Africa, most South Africans don't like hearing this. It's controversial. Most South Africans don't like to be told that, well, you are not as educated in the democratic process. Especially the more educated Africans in the cities, they kind of look askance at someone saying such a thing, that, well, we need more Africans to be more educated about democracy. But we do. How much money does it take a typical South African, for example, a question may be asked, to form a political party, to run for an election? We don't know this. A typical South African doesn't know this. And this right here constitutes this a singular biggest barrier to entry for people, because it favors the incumbent, because you know the incumbent is there, they don't need to work as hard as kind of an outsider.
I think the big challenge with election management in general is that there needs to be more transparency. It's not that elections are too complicated. It's what gets invested in raising awareness around that process. Elections can make things too easy for ordinary citizens. Every 4 or 5 years, your way of holding your politicians accountable is by casting a ballot. You forget about the day after, what you're supposed to also do. You forget about tackling all of those other issues which make society function. People spoke about the fact that there's corruption involved. We need to be able to have those mechanisms in place where ordinary citizens can, beyond the ballot box, call out those kinds of things that they see, social injustices and so forth in society. And this is where it becomes a day-to-day kind of endeavor. It boils down to the kind of education we receive at school about being engaged citizens. I must say, man, it's hard. You're struggling to put bread on the table, and you're having to worry about politicians at the same time. These competing priorities that kind of push and pull you. But the more we can encourage ordinary people, ordinary citizens, voters to do more than elections, to assist their neighbor. And I think on the African continent, we hear of things like Ubuntu, the kind of spirit of coming together, and a number of other kinds of common understandings. We need to be encouraging more of that. And that encouragement speaks to more than just going to cast your vote every 4 or 5 years. It's about being a good citizen every single day.
Now, in some countries, we also see the courts weigh in on the outcome of an election or when results are disputed. Of course, we've seen that in Kenya, we've seen it in Malawi, same here in the United States. Is that a good practice, Pio Kushle, to ultimately have the courts decide an election?
It's a good thing. There's a less cynical perspective that it's a good thing. It shows that the legislature, while it has its role in the executive, there is an unelected professional, professional, non-biased group of people, the judiciary, that can hold their feet to the fire and keep the country going, as Rushdie has said. It basically, the ship steers and it remains steady. And people's lives are not adversely affected. Because as we saw in Kenya in the 2000s, sometimes in South Africa, these things, people's lives can get lost through an election, a dispute of an election. So we can't play with people's lives. And so sometimes the judiciary is the last line of defense to actually, if we may appreciate, save people's lives. The longer a dispute goes in some places, it means the tension is going to boil over, as we've seen in far too many instances. But a more cynical view, of course, of this, maybe even including in South Africa, it may be that, well, sometimes the judiciary itself is called into question. And no one likes when a judiciary among the politicians, no one likes when the judges find against them. So you will find then that in South Africa, the judges sometimes are played for sport. Perhaps if one former president is found in contempt and goes to jail without trial, some people will cheer that and some people will not. But the judiciary must itself be accountable. It must know that when politicians fail in the legislature and the executive, they are the last. And the cynical view is that far too often the judiciary in African countries, unfortunately, is, as South Africans call this, deployed. These are deployee people. So you know that, okay, we have out of 9, our judges are 6 and 3. And so it becomes a numbers game. Not all African countries, but sometimes you find that, and that's not good. That's not good for democracy. It undermines the whole process.
Vincent, how did this play out in Kenya?
You know, you have to go back to the events of 2007. There was, so much violence after a disputed election. So many people died. And so Kenya has come a long way. Eventually, they actually wrote a brand new constitution and created a very independent judiciary so that in the last few elections, when there was a dispute, and especially the dispute which led to nullification of an election, the courts really, played their role very effectively, and there was so much respect on the court system. Of course, there was a repeat of the election. The opposition boycotted. Why did the opposition boycott? It's because they said there won't be any difference in the results because the electoral body was the same, and it was expect to bungle the elections once again, and it was manipulatable. And for that reason, in fact, people have wondered why the opposition keeps preparing for the next election without having those kind of changes at the electoral body to ensure that the person who will run the elections will do a good job, so that you don't even have to go to the courts, in fact, to have these things litigated. So to the point I was making, the politicians, if they had an interest in really having a free, fair, and credible elections, they need to spend a lot of time working on reforms to the body that conducts the elections. So before you think of the court system, you need to make sure that the electoral body, the electoral system, is first, it's independent and it is strong enough to withstand any pressures, whether from the incumbent or from the opposition. And I think it's a lesson that Kenyans didn't learn, because even after that nullification of that election, there hasn't been such a strong push to create an electoral body and electoral system that will ensure that the next elections will not be disputed. I actually expect that to be the scenario the next time around, because that electoral body that conducted the last election stays as it was. One of the promises that the current president made was to kind of crush the court, the high court. He threatened the Supreme Court at that time, and the politicians in the country who have an interest in having a free, fair, and credible election, whether it is in Kenya, South Africa, or any other African country, have to really focus on the body that is entrusted with running the elections. Because if that body is not credible, then you will have an election every 5 years, and you'll dispute those elections, and then it will again go through the same cycle, probably go to the courts, but we don't know if it will always end the same way.
And Rushdie, we're seeing more examples here in the US and, of course, now in Brazil, where the groundwork is laid for casting doubt over the election even before the election is held. Do you think this will become a more common feature in elections in future and in more countries around the world?
That's a key question. And Vincent's kind of also spoken about this issue of having this kind of guardrail bodies to kind of keep democracy on track. And I think there are two. It used to be that elections themselves were the big safety valves to prevent conflict. So you go and vote, everybody accepts the election result, society moves on. Nowadays, is everybody goes to vote, and it's the courts that actually act as the safety valve. And we've seen at least in two cases on the African continent, both Kenya and Malawi, annulment of election results. And that served to kind of quell pressures and frustrations that people were feeling on the streets. But when one kind of looks at these institutions, and if you are to draw this back to the United States as well, strong institutions, as Vincent mentioned, they need to be credible, they need to be trusted, they need to be able to withstand those pressures, and they themselves need to be strengthened from further weakening. We saw this in the Gambia. Suddenly there was an unexpected change, that the vote was counted as it was cast, and the incumbent lost. And that was a big surprise. I mean, we've seen this recently in Zambia also, unexpected change. When institutions do what they're supposed to do with integrity and with honesty and with transparency, and they count the votes as people have cast them, I think the chances are far higher that people will stop trusting those institutions rather than saying, oh, it's a foregone conclusion, we don't have to go and vote, the ruling party is going to win this time anyway, and so forth. So I think that there's a lot to be said, and precedents setting cases like Kenya, like Malawi, have opened people's eyes to the fact that there might be other mechanisms by which election results could be looked at with credibility. And so you see the need for these entities to be made stronger. It cannot be that a sitting president outrightly criticizes the judiciary and gets away with it. We're supposed to be having this system of governance where there are checks and balances and accountabilities built in, and ordinary citizens need to find ways to kind of speak up to ensure that those guardrails of democracy are play the role that they're supposed to, even when the politicians are fighting it out and so forth, that ordinary voters and citizens have faith that there are these safety valves in society that will not degenerate into violence. And I think that's one of the key things to be looking at.
Well, gentlemen, we are going to leave it there. Peo Kushle Mnyandu, Rushdie Nakadin, and Vincent Makori. Gentlemen, I thank you so much for your time. Thanks for being here. We're going to take a short break here on Straight Talk Africa. When we return, we'll have results from our Facebook poll. You may have seen, we've asked you in our online audience across the continent if you plan to vote in your country's next election. We'll have those results and your comments when Straight Talk Africa returns.
From around the world, let's go.
You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. We're discussing whether people trust elections and how that affects their plans to vote. If you're part of our Straight Talk Africa online audience, you probably saw this poll question we posted on social media. We asked, will you vote in your country's next election? 47% of you said yes and 53% said no. Now, here are also some comments that we received to that question. Steve Ible Babone in Uganda says, as much as the elections are not free and fair in Uganda, I will continue voting for whoever I want. Kennedy Sitati in Kenya believes voting is a waste of time because essentially every vote does not count. What he calls frontliners are always ahead before voting is done. The actual voting event is just a formality designed to fool the international community that democracy is respectfully practiced. Chan Makuok Chuol in South Sudan says, I will definitely cast my vote if there shall be an election. Juliet Asante in Uganda asks, why should I keep on voting when there is no change? And Angela Lovely also in Uganda says, yes, my vote may not change the results, but it has to be counted. Now, we also asked if you trust the election process in your country to be fair. Hamidu Lubega in Uganda says elections in many African countries are a hoax to signify democracy to the West for grants, donations and loans by African dictators. Neve Jones Mpundu Langeni in Zambia says, we just held an election where someone was confident of winning, but his dirty tactics never worked. We voted massively for Bali, which is also a nickname for the new Zambian president, and defeated the incumbent. Only in my country, Zambia. Eliud Sabila in Uganda says, I have lost the meaning of electoral process in my country. We no longer get excited that we're going to change the bad leaders. Rather, we are afraid of how many people will be jailed and killed on the streets. Steve Onuma Egbu in Nigeria says, no, it's often fraught with irregularities. At its best, elections are totally unfair and rigged, and so do not reflect the choice and the will of the broad masses, the already oppressed and impoverished people. Dominic Mashapa in South Africa says, I think the elections in my country, South Africa, are free but not fair. Thank you so much for all these responses. We have so many more on social media. You can go there and check them out and even join the conversation. On the next Straight Talk Africa, my conversation with the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, about the global fight against COVID-19 and what is at risk for African women as countries try to cope and recover from the pandemic. Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa. And that is how we will wrap it up this week. On behalf of the Straight Talk Africa team, a big thank you to all of our guests and to you, our audience, for joining us from across Africa and other parts of the world. Thank you for always watching and always listening. Go well. Goodbye.